Guns N' Roses' debut 1987 album, Appetite for Destruction, has sold 38 million copies worldwide. For millions of rock fans, they are the band, the gold standard of heavy drinking, hard partying, no-nonsense L.A. rock and roll. Yet in 1990, as their popularity was on the rise, Steven Adler, their first drummer, was forced to leave. In a new memoir written with Lawrence J. Spaniola, Mr. Adler explains why, as he chronicles his early life, his tenure with the band, his drug addiction, and his struggles to get clean. My Appetite for Destruction, Sex, Drugs, and Guns N' Roses is published by It Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings Steven Adler to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
What do you mean when you say you have a rage to represent?
Well, you know, there's so many people out there that actually have my same story. Like with my book, in the beginnings, it talks about, I talk about, with where I had this, when I was a young teenager, there was sexual abuse in my life that happened. And I thought that saying that out loud to other people to hear something like that was going to hurt me more, but it was the complete opposite. It was like a release, and I think everybody should do that. I mean, everybody can't write their own book or have it published, but they can write their own book.
But you had success, and yet these demons continued to plague you. The success is not enough?
No, the success has nothing to do with the demons. That was the pleasant part. The demons came from my childhood, and I just didn't realize that I was stuffing all those childhood memories down with the drugs. I thought I was just doing it because that's what rock and roll is. You know, that's a part of rock and roll. That's the era I grew up in. You know, the rock stars that I looked up to, they made out with a lot of girls. They traveled around the world. They did a lot of drugs. The thing is that we didn't know that they didn't print in the magazine interviews was the times when they were sick and they were throwing up and they couldn't get on stage and they OD'd. You didn't hear about that till recently.
Well, some we do know about a few. Janis Joplin,
well, yes.
Jim Morrison, Jimi Hendrix, they well, all died as a result of drug use. And
yes.
That was before you really came on the scene. Were you were you taking drugs already at that time? Or was
oh,
that
yeah. I was taking drugs since 11.
11.
11. I know. I look at 11-year-old kids now, and I don't think I was ever that small. It's like, oh, my God. How, and the
what
sexual
kind of drugs
abuse
were you
stuff?
Doing?
Well, you know, drinking, smoking pot, acid.
And that was all because a direct result of the sexual abuse?
Well, that and the my childhood with abandonment. Like my mother, you know, my father left before I was born. My mother, I had an older brother. She can't, you know, she was by herself. She couldn't support us both, so she kind of gave me up to my grandparents, which in the end worked out for me. But I didn't realize it. I guess I had a thing with abandonment. And that's what kind of hurt me when the band abandoned me.
Well, throughout this book, you get the feeling you're constantly trying to get your mother's approval.
Well, isn't everybody?
Yeah, well, but
you know,
there's
one
but
way
there's
or
a
another.
Difference if your mother has, as you said, abandoned you. I don't know if I should ask you for details on the sexual abuse, but
well, I was like 12 years old, and I was hanging out with an older teenager. He took me over to a house, and there was an older man there, and they gave me drugs, and I had no idea what was going on, and I was taken advantage of.
When did you start playing the drums?
When I was 12, 11, 12.
Around the same time.
Same time. Everything happened then. I think now that I look back and see other people's lives, and that's when people's lives really start.
Well,
you know, that you can't drink till you're 21, but you're living life.
You were a poor kid, and a drum kit can be rather expensive.
I bought my first drum kit from Earl Scheib's grandson.
Earl Scheib, the guy who painted the cars.
Yes. And I worked at it. I was mowing lawns, and I saved up $100, and I went to his house in Chatsworth, California. And the guy's dad was so mean. He wouldn't give me the drum set unless I bought the cymbals too. I thought it all came together, and he made me pay another $25.
Well, cymbals are expensive,
you know. They were garbage can lids, and I broke them the first time I used them. But he was Earl Sive, and he got $25 out of me. $25.95.
He needed that money from a 12-year-old kid.
Yeah.
Now, was it always rock for you? Because rock drumming is quite different from jazz drumming or drumming for pop music in general.
But, you know, actually, my influences are more English 60s style drummers, which are really jazz drummers, just rocking it up a little bit. Like Roger Taylor from Queen. He's one of my biggest influences.
Mm-hmm. And was your mother supportive of you becoming a musician?
She wasn't around. You know, I was so running the streets. You know, I was living with my grandmother from zero age till probably seven. And then my mother married my stepfather, Melvin. He adopted us, and I lived with them from 7 to 11. Then when I was 11, which is a little kid, mm-hmm. I don't care what anybody says, I was running the streets. I mean, my grandparents were, thank God, wonderful people and strong people and taught me a lot about life. But they had their kids. They raised them. And, you know, it was much easier for me to just run around the streets. And actually, it was the time.
But what about bands? How did you want to? You were in a bunch of bands before Guns N' Roses.
Oh, yeah. The whole idea was never giving up and always believing in myself. And I would have the any kind of job because I was, to pay my dues and to play with anybody I could. And the only way to get good is to practice and to play. And the more people you play with, the more people you'll find out who you play with, you connect with while you're playing.
So that's how Guns N' Roses came together? Yep. People who had played in other bands?
We played in other bands, and then we played in bands together, and then we all came together as one.
Was Axl Rose the leader from the start?
You know what? There wasn't a leader. We were five guys. Once a Jet, always a Jet. You know, we were a gang. But we didn't fight. I mean, if we had to, we did. We were, teenagers aren't scared to get a bloody nose. But we did our fighting with our music.
Although the drummer's always seen as something of a guy, of a side man. He's the guy who has to just keep the time going and keep everybody else in check.
Well, I make sure.
And not rush
I
make sure or that drag I, tempos.
I call it the look at me. I make sure when I'm playing, everybody looks at me.
When you started, what kind of a band did you aspire to be?
A rock and roll band.
Did you turn out to be the kind of band
exactly.
you were imagining from the start?
When we were recording Appetite for Destruction, we were in the studio, Rumbo Studios in Canoga Park. And every time we'd go in, we'd play a song, we'd go back into the listening booth. And every time we listen to a song, we go, this is going to be the greatest record ever. Mm. This is going to be the biggest record ever. We knew it. We didn't doubt it. We all had the same goal. And that's so hard. There's so many musicians and so many bands, but to get four or five guys to connect the way we did. And you can tell when the last song I recorded with those guys was Civil War, and it's Use Your Illusion. You listen to that song, and then after that song's over, you can hear it's a different band. It was the five of us. We each knew what each other were going to do before we knew it.
But, Pete Best said the same thing about the Beatles.
Oh, look what Pete Best is.
He left. Okay, after he left, and that guy Ringo Starr came in,
and
everything
Ringo.
Went downhill, right?
Yeah.
Guns N' Roses wasn't your first name, was it?
No, there was Road Crew, there was Rose, there was Hollywood Rose, Titus Sloan, Road Crew.
When you did Guns N' Roses, you knew that was the name.
The Guns N' Roses came about from Tracy Guns, from LA Guns, and Axl Rose, so Guns N' Roses. And they rehearsed. See, we all played together. We all, the same clique, and we all played different bands together. And the drummer they had, Rob Gardner, and Tracy Guns on guitar, then it was Duff and Izzy and Axl. And Duff hooked up three shows, one in Seattle and two in Oregon. And Tracy and Rob Gardner didn't want to do it. They didn't want to. you know, they were afraid to leave the, you know, city. And they called us up, and we were, let's go. And we made it to Bakersfield. The car broke down. We were on the freeway. Oh, no, first we got a...
I've been to Bakersfield. You don't want your car to break down.
Nuh-uh. So we're at this truck stop over there, and I asked the truck driver if he was going up north, if he give us a ride. He gave us a ride up north for a couple, for 100 miles or so. We're on, five of us, with the guitars and my stick bag, hitchhiking on the freeway. Okay, so you can imagine that picture. And two hippie chicks picked us up. You can read it in my book. Everything's there.
Steven Adler has written a book with the help of Lawrence J. Spaniola called My Appetite for Self-Destruction, Sex and Drugs and Guns and Roses.
You know, doing this book has been so mentally and spiritually and emotionally therapeutically healing for me.
Now, you said when you made the record, you thought this is going to be the biggest record.
No, we never doubted it.
But how long did it take for it actually to take off?
Yeah, as far as we felt, we were doing what we wanted to do the whole time, so it seemed like a day.
Mm-hmm.
But it was probably about 6, 7 months and 9 months.
And how old were you when this was all happening?
21, 22.
So, but you were already taking drugs all the time?
Oh, yeah, but I wasn't doing the heroin. There's a story in my book where I walked in on Slash and Izzy at Izzy's apartment when I was like 18. And I walked in and they were in the kitchen shooting up. And I was so naive to it. I was like, what is that? You know, what are you doing? And then my grandmother, who had diabetes, had a box of syringes. And this is how naive I was. I go, oh, my grandma's got a whole box of those. And I'm telling you, I had to leave immediately, get back on the bus, go down to Fairfax and Santa Monica and get them. I got a couple of them for them, and I walked back. They were so happy.
But yet you wound up with the bigger problem.
Yeah. Well,
they were
some
able
people
to keep
handle
it,
it better. Some people can handle drugs better, that's all.
Steven Tyler of Aerosmith once saw you high, and what was his response?
That was, I could swear, when I looked at him, he looked at me. It was the third time I ever did heroin, and I didn't get sick. Like I did it like two times before throughout the couple of years. And I was so sick. I never want to do this again. You could read that in the book too. But he looked at me like the devil was actually standing right behind me. And first he was talking to some fans. It was a meet and greet after a show. We just played with them. And he looked up at me, and I'm standing all trying to look all cool, all rock and roll and everything. And he looks up at me and had this big smile, and then his smile was just wiped off his face.
He spotted it immediately.
He saw it instantly. And I can actually tell you that is when my whole life started to go in the toilet.
But as you said, other members of the band were taking drugs. Yeah. Why did you get to the point where you asked to leave?
I couldn't stop doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And it started getting to be more important.
It was affecting your performances?
Of course.
And then you wound up, your life went in a real downward spiral. You attempted suicide on three occasions.
Three? Jeez, every day I tried doing that.
Had you been suffering from depression while you were with the group?
No. But once I found, you know, from working with Dr. Drew on the celebrity rehab, I learned so much from him and from doing that, that I found out I was stuffing so many things down I didn't even know about.
Well, in looking over what you've been through, 28 overdoses, you could have died with pretty much any of them. The suicide attempts, two
it's
heart
not that
attacks.
Easy to kill yourself.
You had a stroke.
A coma for 4 days.
You were in jail. All because of drugs. And why did it take you so long to go into rehab?
Because I wouldn't face my demons. I didn't know how to face my demons. I didn't realize it was so simple as to just talk about it.
But you mentioned Dr. Drew Pinsky. What was different about that allowed you to change?
He gave me the opportunity. He didn't push me or rush me. He said, when you're ready, you can do it. And this was there for me. He's there for everybody. He gives everybody the same chance. But it's all that matters is what you do with it. You know, he gives you the opportunity. You could either take it or leave it.
And you wound up, now you have your own band?
I have my own band. I have a new single coming out tomorrow. Well, you can get the single when you buy the book on a free download. And like I said, I got
the
book.
And the band is called Adler's Appetite.
Adler's Appetite.
And Steve Adler will be giving a reading and signing books at the Book Review in Huntington tonight. And then on Wednesday, he'll be at Bookends in Ridgewood, New Jersey at noon. Any performances coming up?
Yes, Philadelphia tomorrow night.
And we have...
Or Tuesday night.
We have Welcome to the Jungle to go out with.
All right.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Stephen Adler.
Thank you so much.
Wrote with Lawrence J. Spaniola, My Appetite for Destruction, Sex and Drugs and Guns and Roses. It's published by It Books.
And you go to AdlersAppetiteOnline.com. Check everything out. Check all the shows. Jungle. Welcome.